Accession number 15479, real one.
Mr. Dairy One, where were you born, please?
Amneford, South Wales.
Which year was this?
1923.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a dentist.
Did you go to school at Amneford?
Yes.
How old were you when you left?
17, I think. Must have been 42... 18.
How did the war affect you in that area in the early days of the war?
Well, we were far enough away from any sort of war targets to be not really affected. The biggest effect on me as a schoolboy was that two London schools were evacuated to the town. The Roan School in Greenwich and Addie and Stanhope. So we had to fit our lessons in with theirs. In fact, they brought forward our schooling from, I think we started at something like 8 o'clock in the morning and finished at 3. So, and then they started at 3 and went on from there.
How did the evacuees get on with the locals?
Oh, very well, yes. I've often wondered how, you know, we made friends with quite a few of them. I wondered how they got on.
Were they much different from the local people or much the same?
Very similar, I would have thought. Probably... a slightly higher social background than the local people. And Amneford was a mining town, but on the fringe of the anthracite belt. So you had sort of, on the edge of the town, you had farming, agriculture, and then on the other side, it was all coal mines. So the main employer in the area would have been the mines, whereas the evacuees were presumably from families where the fathers commuted, would have been London businessmen, I suppose.
Did any bombs fall in the Amneford area?
None, no. The nearest was Swansea.
Did you see anything of the bombing of Swansea?
Yes, I was actually in Swansea one night when it was bombed. And I spent an hour or so in an air raid shelter with my sister and her husband.
Where was the air raid shelter?
In their garden, in Anderson Shelter.
Which
I can't remember the year, I was actually in the Air Force or it was before.
I think the heavy bombing of Swansea was in 41.
Oh, in that case, it was before, yes, it was before I joined up. And I must have been visiting and one of these heavy raids. And my father came down the next day. His war effort was to give up his private practice and join the schools, because the school dentists had been called up. So he thought that was his war effort, and he was also a superintendent in the special constabulary. And so he still got petrol to go on the school run, and used to fiddle it a bit as well, add tractor vaporizing oil, and extend his mileage, do a bit of recreational driving. So he turned up the next morning, and we drove through Swansea and saw quite a bit of the damage.
Where was most of the damage concentrated?
Oh, in the centre of the town. Oh, they were obviously going for the docks, but it was the town itself, right at the heart of the town, that, from my memory, seemed to suffer. So much so that all the businesses had to move out, the big shops, and into towards a place called the Uplands, which was a part of Swansea, about a mile or so out of Swansea, and you know, all the big department stores and things like that had to move into temporary accommodation on the outskirts.
How frightening was it for you on that night?
Well, it's rather amusing, really, that I mistakenly interpreted the sound of falling bombs as anti-aircraft fire. So while my sister and her husband were cowering, I was laughing my head off, because thinking they were cowering because they thought bombs were dropping on them, and I was laughing because I thought, you know, they don't realize this is anti-aircraft fire, because I was in the wrong. And when the thumps arrived, and I realized, but I realized it was far enough away, and I was young and stupid, I suppose, and didn't think anything of it.
How did public morale in Swansea stand up to the bombing, do you think?
Very well. Yes, very well. I was only 17, as I said, at the time, and 16 or 17. Things like that are not matters that I concern myself with particularly, but from all accounts, you know, the town just rallied and carried on as normal.
Did it create any desire for vengeance?
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think so. No. No. No, nothing.
How did you come to be in the RAF yourself?
Oh, I just couldn't wait till I got in. I was dead keen, following the Battle of Britain, and I had a little booklet that the RAF produced with this very handsome officer's face on the cover, and I used to study it assiduously, you know, with all the ranks and the aircraft and things like that, and I was determined to go into the Air Force, and I couldn't wait until I did.
This is about mid-1942, I think.
Well, I started, my first overtures were in towards the end of 41. The services were running a scheme called the Y scheme, where people, young lads, were enrolled from school. They went to university for a year, and then whilst they were in university, they joined either the, you know, the cadet force or the ATC or whatever branch of the services that they were interested in. In my case, it would have been University Air Squadron. And then that was the equivalent of the initial training wing, ITW, in the, if you joined normally. So I was interviewed, I passed the interview, and failed the medical. The doctor said that I had restricted breathing in my left nostril and sent me home to get something done about it. He said I had polyps, but it transpired I didn't have polyps. I had what was called a deflected septum, the cartilage separate in the nostrils. And it was one of the school doctors. My father took me with him one day to a little village school where he was going to be operating. And there was always a doctor present. And he said, my son's trying to get into the Air Force. They say he's got polyps, but our GP couldn't find any. So we wondered if you could see what was wrong. And she was sitting behind a desk at the opposite end of the room. She just looked up and looked at me and said, oh, he's got a deflected septum at that range. And that's what it transpired to be. So I booked into the local hospital, Glenammon Cottage Hospital, to have this operation. It was a local anaesthetic, and I was wheeled down to the operating theatre with this gauze of dipped in cocaine hydrochloride up my nostril, and stretched out on the table, And the surgeon said, "Oh, you've got polyps, have you?" And I said, "No, I've got deflected septum." So he said, "Well, it's all the same to me." And proceeded to operate. And it was a ghastly thing because the nurse putting the anaesthetic in and said, "You've got to be operated on within half an hour." And this was about 40 minutes later. And when the doctor, the surgeon said, "How long has this been in?" I said, 3/4 of an hour. And the nurse said, no, it was less than half an hour. So he just went on because the stuff had worn off. And it was just like having teeth extracted, every little bit of bone that he wrenched out. I could feel right down to my socks. I then wrote to the Air Force and said, "I've had this operation. When can I join?" And they wrote back and said, "We won't medically re-examine you until 3 months after the operation. And this will make you too late for this year's course and too old for next year's." So I just went to a recruiting station a couple of weeks later and volunteered. And a couple of weeks after that, I was in.
You must have been very keen.
Yes, I was very keen. Yes. And the amusing thing, of course, was that I was medically re-examined within about a month of the operation, whereas they'd said they wouldn't do it for 3 months, and they passed me, and I was in.
What did you think to your early training in Britain?
Oh, I thought it was all fantastic. Usual business. Aircrew reception centre at Lord's Cricket Ground, and the fitting out with uniform, inoculations, all that type of thing, hanging around and waiting for a posting to ITW, which was at Scarborough. And I thought this was fantastic. You know, I really got into it and did rather well, I thought. You know, I was high up in my class, and just enjoyed every minute of it.
How did you get on with flying at first?
Very well. At this stage in the war, the RAF were being a bit more discriminatory, and instead of anybody who wanted to be a pilot given pilot training, they had what they called grading schools. So you did a few hours on a Tiger Moth, and then at the end of that you were graded pilot, navigator, bomb aimer, whatever. So it was only the people who had natural aptitude at the grading school who went on to be trained as a pilot. And this was up at Brough in Yorkshire, just outside Hull. It's still in existence. I think it's Hawker Siddeley or something like
Blackburn's.
That. Yes, Blackburn's. And in fact, on the opposite side of the airfield, they were developing the Firebrand. That was a new fighter that was coming out. And we were all with, and any time we heard he used to start this engine with cartridges, KyGas cartridges. And it was like a very pistol fitted inside the cockpit, and he pulled the trigger and this fired a cartridge, and this pushed the engine round, and that's how it started. So whenever we heard these cartridges going off, everybody would rush out to watch this aircraft take off, and we thought it was the bee's knees. That was in 1942, and that aircraft didn't come into squadron service until after the war was over. I couldn't believe it. Anyway, I'm diverting. I got on very well. The only problem I had initially was in lining up the aircraft in taking off, because being a keen cyclist, I was treating the rudder bar as handlebars. If I wanted to go right, I moved it round. In other words, I pushed my left foot forward, you see. Whereas that makes you go left. it took me some time to realize, you know, to get out of this cycling habit of using the rudder bar like handlebars on a bicycle. And then I got on famously and actually went solo. It was fairly rare for anybody to go solo at grading school. So I had a very good report. They used to give you points out of 1,000, and I think I got 830. So I went out to Canada then to do my continuation training, EFTS, Elementary Flying Training School. And
whereabouts in Canada did you go?
That was at Calgary, just outside Calgary, a place called De Winton, about 20 miles outside Calgary. And I went across the Atlantic on the RMS Andes, which was produced. It wasn't launched until just before the war, so it never went into passenger service. It was impressed into transport, military transport, right from the beginning. But of course, it was a ship that had been designed and built for the South Atlantic waters. And on the North Atlantic waters, crossing in the middle of winter, it was purgatory, because I believe they designed a hull to cope with different swells. And the Atlantic swell, of course, is far different to the South Atlantic swell. And this boat was literally sort of plunging its nose in and then sticking it up in the air. When the nose went down, you could hear the propellers speeding up. They were coming right out of the water. And we were about, below water level. And this, in a cabin, you call it, or what's another word for a room on a ship?
Wardroom?
Probably, yes. Would have been probably for half a dozen seamen. And there were something like 30 or 40 of us in there. And the very first day out, when we left Greenock in the early hours of the morning, something like 5 o'clock in the morning, and I went out on deck, and this was great. You know, there we were. It wasn't too rough, but I began to feel a bit queasy, and this merchant seaman said, "You're looking a bit green." He said, "I got just the thing for you." And he marched me along these decks, up and down stairs, and eventually he came to a door in the side of the ship, and he opened it up, came out with a mop and a pail, and he said, "Get mopping." And all the time I was thinking he was going to come up with a pill or a potion of some kind that would get rid of my... Because I started mopping, and that was the worst possible thing. The next thing, I was leaning over the side. And it was terrible. I would say 90%, 95% of the airmen on board were violently ill. We were in hammocks. All, they were like fishtailed. They were like that. You could lean across and touch the hammock about four hammocks away. And people were so ill, they weren't even getting out of the hammocks to be ill. They were just leaning over the side, and the floor was awash. And there was a washroom alongside, and if you went in there, the basins were full to the top, blocked. It was absolutely hell. It was the only thing to call it. And it was a 5-day crossing. It wasn't until the last day that we started to get our sea legs. And it was, I'll never forget it. We docked at Halifax on Christmas Day, 1942. Before docking, we had a breakfast on board, which was what we call soya links. These were sausages, so-called, and that was at 5 o'clock. We were put on this troop train. We left Halifax about 9 o'clock in the morning. We arrived at Moncton about 6 o'clock at night, and we'd had nothing to eat all day, Christmas Day. When we got to Moncton, well, we did stop halfway at the place called Truro, and they said, you know, we're just picking up water. We'll be pulling out in 20 minutes, so don't get off the train, because everybody got off. And I remember walking along the streets, and you could smell the Christmas dinners cooking. You can imagine the effect this had on us. Oh, it was terrible. Anyway, somehow or other, the word got around, and the next thing was, it was like bush telegraph. Everybody started making towards one of these warehouses, and there were apples in storage, and people came out, the locals were coming out with enormous baskets, which they had to hold on to the handles with both hands, filled with apples, and these hundreds of airmen descending on them. I managed to get two, and that was all I had all day. The only people who had any food in that train were the people who hadn't suffered from seasickness, and they'd been working in the galley. And before they left the ship, they'd been given food to take with them. And these chaps were sitting down in the train, eating this, and all we could do was watch them eat it. They certainly didn't hand any around. And then when we got to Moncton, the first thing that happens any time you arrive in a new station is what they call the FFI, inspection, free from infection, which means dropping your slacks, and they see if you've got any infection, scabies or whatever. And the doctor doing this examination was a woman. You can imagine these hundreds of airmen dropping their slacks, and this woman going up and down the line. And then eventually they took us to the dining rooms, but all the food had gone. All they could do was serve up scrambled eggs and tinned tomatoes. So that was my Christmas dinner, 1942. We then hung around for weeks waiting for postings, and then eventually got on a troop train for Western Canada, and they were dropping people off on the way, so what was normally a 3-day journey took 5 days. Everything happens. We had axle grease boxes catching fire. We had everything happened. And the last straw, by the time we got to Calgary, there were only 13 of us out of the 100, you know, because there were training stations all along the way, you see, and they were dropping off 20 here, 20 there, 20 somewhere else, in Ontario, Saskatchewan, you name it. So, as I say, we were the last ones, and there were 13 of us. And when we got off the train, they said, there's been an outbreak of scarlet fever, so you'll be in quarantine. And they put us on this little bus to go out to the 20 miles to DeWinton. And the bus broke down. And this was in the middle of winter, might have been in the new year, 43. Absolutely freezing. And we thought our end had come. Some of them started walking, and after a few hundred yards, they just sort of sat down in the ditch and thought the last days had come. Literally freezing to death. And then another bus came along, and they took us in. And almost everybody had frostbite, on top of the fact that we were quarantined. So then what would happen was that this station had been a civilian flying school, so it was still operated by civilians. All the maintenance was done, all the catering was done by civilians. The only Air Force presence was administration and the instructors. And we were segregated. We had to go into the dining room after everybody else had eaten, with all our own crockery and cutlery. And I think the incubation period was something like 14 days. And it was incredible that on about the 14th day, somebody else would go down with scarlet fever. So that would extend the quarantine period another 14 days. And then at the 14th day, somebody else would go down. And in the end, oh, it must have been there 6 or 7 weeks or longer when we'd been confined to camp and segregated before we were eventually given a clean bill of health, and only about 4 people didn't get scarlet fever. But the training went on just as normal. I don't know what the RAF instructors thought of this being exposed to us. The other thing, of course, was that I'd arrived there with this very good record. I'd been solo, I'd had high marks, so everything was expected of me. But the big difference was that the place was covered in snow. So we, instead of taking off from grass, we were taking off from compacted snow. And it obviously had affected me, because I took another, initially I'd taken about 8 hours to go solo. It took me another 7 or 8 hours to go solo again. And that was quite a disappointment, not only to me, but I think the instructors were disappointed with me. Anyway, I progressed, and all this time, of course, I think I was in common with everybody who volunteered to become a pilot in the Air Force, had ambitions of being a fighter pilot. I certainly did. And as a result of this delay in going solo again, one or two other things that happened during the training, when we were posted from there to SFDS, Service Flying Training School, instead of going on to single engine aircraft and subsequently, and consequently, I should say, fighters, I was very disappointed to be posted to a twin engine SFDS. So that was the end of my ambitions to be a fighter pilot.
What did you think of the instruction that you got in Canada?
It varied. Some of the instructors were people who'd been pilots for some time, had probably seen operational flying, and this was part of their sort of between ops flying, so they were very good. But some of the instructors were people who'd probably only qualified a few months, got their wings a few months before, and were very inexperienced and not psychologically suited to instructing, I don't think. So they were not very good. You inevitably get clashes, personality clashes, but they shouldn't. After the war, I continued flying, civil flying, and throughout my flying career, which went stretched over 40 years, I found there were several instructors who were psychologically unsuited. They'd chosen to become instructors for the wrong reasons. Instead of being dedicated to it, they decided to become instructors because of the perks or the what